So this is the second part of the second seminar on writing the history of the First World War. Now, I've almost finished talking about military history, not quite. Now, the history which is produced in universities, which is one section of history, has become much more varied over the last 50 years or so. And even sometimes you could get the impression that military history is going out of fashion, even about the First World War, that other kinds of history are more popular. This is absolutely not the case, however, if you look at history more widely. And certainly in the bookshops and in the municipal libraries, there is more military history than any other sort about the First World War. In the universities, there is less. So this will be interesting to look at why, you know, why this difference between what the enthusiasts want to read and what the historians want to write. It's also the case, as I will be showing a little later on, that histories of the First World War can be quite controversial. Now, there's a big political debate going on about what is important about the First World War. Memoirs and diaries sell very well in the bookshops. People like to read these, and in particular, they can sell based on local identities. That is to say that in one particular town, people like to read the diary of a man from this town who was in the First World War, and we'll be coming back to that. We have now more or less every kind of soldier has a diary or two. There have also been a series of collections of oral history, which I'll be looking at in the moment. In a moment. Now, when you're talking about the life of the individual soldier, there are a lot of different ways of looking at it. And here you have I have one last particular experience within the military, and that is this book, which is about being executed. Yeah, that's a particular experience, I suppose. Blindfolded and alone. And what British military executions in the Great War? And this is Catherine Coyne and John Hughes Wilson, who they took all of the files on all of the British executions and saw what they could do. Some of the files had disappeared in the 1920s. We don't know why, but they took them all. And one of the things that one of the biggest conclusions they came up with is that how it worked was, you see, if you ran away, you were court-martialed and sentenced to death, but very often you were not executed. The military hierarchy would intervene and commute your sentence and say, okay, you've been sentenced to death, but you're not going to be executed, you're going to prison instead. And this question of being executed or being commuted, having your sentence commuted, fundamentally depended on the situation of the war. If the war was going quite well, that is that the British army was winning, they didn't execute many people. But if the war was going quite badly, then they executed more people to encourage the others, as you say in French, pour encourager les autres. And that was the most important thing. So if you were lucky, you ran away while the war was going well for the British Army. There's a wonderful story in France where there were three soldiers sentenced to death up in the Chemin des Dames. And one of them escaped during the night and walked back to the southwest, southwest of France, to his village. And they smuggled him to Spain, and he lived happily the rest of his life in Spain. But that's not easy to do. But okay. What's this one then? I'm getting carried away here. This is the first French book about the mutinies. So particular experiences within the military, and I already talked about the Christmas truce. This book by Malcolm Brown and Shirley Seaton is about the Christmas truce. That is to say, in Christmas 1914, when different armies agreed not to fight for a day, 2 days, 3 days. And the hierarchy of the army were very worried. because you know you didn't want people to get into the habit. And they went onto no man's land and they played football together with the Germans and made tea and drank schnapps and whiskey. And it's very fascinating story. And the most important thing about it is it's not really one truce. It is an initiative which was taken independently in 40 or 50 different places across the front. So it's quite an interesting dynamic. There are also other interesting questions about the truce. First of all, in every case, the Germans initiated the truce. The Germans started singing Christmas carols and then came out of the trench and said, oh, you know, it's Christmas, let's not fight, and so on. And this is a question that I asked myself, you know, why did the Germans begin the truce every time? I'm talking about where it's British and German, because that's what I know about. Have you anybody got an idea about that? Anybody know Germany at all well? Because because you might think, oh yeah, maybe the Germans were much more intelligent or much more pacifist. That's not the correct answer. Anybody got an idea? It's a very, very simple answer. In England, Christmas celebrations begin on the morning of the 25th. And in Germany, Christmas celebrations begin at the evening of the 24th. So it's quite simply that for the Germans it was already Christmas, and for the English it wasn't Christmas yet, and so the Germans began. There's a second reason, and that is that some of the Germans spoke English, and the English did not speak German, so nothing different there. They were also lucky in that they shared a religion, and so many of the religious hymns for Christmas were the same, just with different languages, like, you know, Stille Nacht, or things like that. So that Christmas truce, particular experiences within the military, and I'm not going to do that. There's two particular series of books on military history that I want to look at now, because as I was saying, as the years went by, military historians began more and more to be interested in the experience of the individual soldier. And it might be considered that this was perhaps not subversive, but a little bit transgressive, because if your main interest is the individual soldier, that's like you don't care who wins the war, in a way. Now, it's a very complicated question, because in general today in Britain, that a lot of people don't care who won the First World War. Now, the First World War. What do you think about the First World War? A very, very common opinion is it was a complete waste. And this is not the general attitude about the Second World War. The general attitude about the Second World War is, oh, it was very sad and tragic, but necessary. And so you have very different general attitudes for the two different wars. I'm not saying who's right or wrong. It's just very interesting that the First World War still has a very bad press. So in any case, if you're interested mostly in the individual soldier, that doesn't sound so patriotic or nationalistic. And so one set of writers tried to solve this problem by writing a series of books on the VCs. The VC. Now, a VC is a medal, the Victoria Cross. It is the highest medal you can get in the British Army. I've forgotten exactly the description, but basically you have to do something where you were very lucky not to be killed. You know, you have to do something. That is something silly, yeah. But you know, so you have to exhibit extreme bravery. I'm putting that in inverted commas to get them. So here you have the lives of individual people, but only the people who were decorated for extreme bravery by the British government. So here you have, it's very interesting politically, because it means you can talk about ordinary people's lives and still glorify our heroes by only talking about the VCs. There have been a series of initiatives around this. For example, there was an initiative to have a particular mini monument in the street of every place where a VC lived from the First World War. And what they did, you know, British post boxes, they're red. Red round things like that, you know, not this yellow horrible stuff, red round ones. And what they did is they painted them gold. Why not? Okay. And a whole series of them, the VCs of the First World War at Gallipoli, it's a battle. The VCs of the First World War at Arran and Messines. The VCs of the First World War at Cambrai. The VCs in the Air Force in the First World War. Yeah, so huge numbers of books, which are, you know, which sell quite well, which you can buy in the British Library, for example, and at the, of course, the Imperial War Museum. So this was a particular kind of patriotic history. A particular way of perhaps saving patriotic history from this trend to talk about ordinary people. So that was an interesting idea there. And the other set of books, which is still in military history, which I already mentioned, is the oral history. In the 1960s, I think, the British Library said, hey, you know, let's interview a lot of people who lived through the First World War, because there are not so many left. And they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of interviews. And these books are selections of interviews, forgotten voices of the Great War. Now, there's something very typical about the title there, Forgotten Voices, because if you write a history book, you have to sell it. That's the idea, yeah? And so it's always very, very important to say that the story is forgotten or untold. Yeah, you see that in almost every book, it says it. The untold story of, you know, the forgotten story of, yeah, because it's almost a marketing ploy. Really. So that's Forgotten Voices of the Great War. Number one. Number two. Number three. And number four. Number four is perhaps the most interesting one. It's not quite the same, because these were interviews in the 1960s, whereas this was a man who went round to the retirement homes and interviewed 90-year-old men. He did the interviews himself. What happened just after the First World War? How had life changed? A slightly different approach there. But still the experiences of the military. And now there's something about oral history which is very, very important. And the first thing about that is that many, many soldiers never told their stories. It was very typical to say nothing about your experience in the army. Firstly, because boys don't like to talk about feelings, and this was even worse 100 years ago. In fact, it was very, very solidly ingrained in the men of the time that, you know, men do not talk in public about their experiences. And secondly, only in the 1970s was there a few historians who cared enough to go to find the people and get their story. So much for military history. And I haven't really spoken very much about diplomatic history, which is about the different strategies and methods the governments used to persuade other governments to help them in different ways, or to manage to be successfully neutral. Many countries in the First World War were neutral. Spain was neutral during the First World War. And it was rather a delicate situation, because much of the elite in Spain supported the Germans, and most of the people supported the other side, for historic reasons. Portugal was neutral at the beginning and then joined the war, but I think they only had one battle. They had a very short war, Portugal. So the workings of their diplomacies, yeah, how they managed international relations, forms a certain form of history. Okay, so we got to the end of military and diplomatic history, and it brings us onto our second field, which is social history. Has to whiz round one. Okay, so what is social history? Anybody like to try a definition of social history? Would you like to try a definition of social history? Well, it's history which is social, isn't it? What kind of questions would you imagine people would ask for social history? They must be different questions from military history. What kind of questions would you want to ask? Any ideas? This is new to you, really, isn't it? Anybody like to try and guess a question for social history? We won't laugh at you if you're wrong. Well, let's see if we have a definition now. I might have a definition here. Social history, also in the Oxford Dictionary. The history of society or of social behaviour. History with an emphasis on social structures. Yeah, number two does not apply here. It's a different meaning which has nothing to do with history. The history of society or of social behaviour. History with an emphasis on social structures. So we can see that it's more difficult than before. It's more complicated than military history. Emphasis on social structures. So let's look at the war and see what difference did it make to social structures. What happened to the family? What happened to the trade unions? What happened to the working class? What happened to the middle class? What happened to Oxford and Cambridge? Yeah, Oxford and Cambridge, obviously. Social structures, yeah, elite social structures. What happened to them because of the war? Because the First World War was the first total war. It was the first time, because the British had seen a lot of wars in the 1870s. There was war in Africa. In the 1880s, there was war in the Crimea. I've got the dates wrong for the Crimea. There. In the 1898, there was the war in South Africa against the Boers. The British had a lot of wars, but the wars were, firstly, always a long way away, and secondly, generally against people who didn't have any weapons. So it was easy to win. Wonderful film Zulu, if you ever get to see it, about the British fighting the Zulus. But you know, it's like machine guns against against spears. Well, repeater rifles against spears, anyway. So history with an emphasis on social structures. So the social history of the First World War, along with social history in general, rises in the 1950s. In the 1930s, nobody really cares very much. In the 1940s, not either. It's in the 50s and 60s especially that social history becomes very important, not just for the First World War, but also for the First World War. So why does social history become important in the 1960s? Well, this is all to do with universities, isn't it? So we have about 25 people here. How many people, raise your hand if your father went to university? Did your father go to university? Okay, stop. Raise your hand if your grandfather went to university. Yeah, okay. Raise your hand if you know that your great-grandfather went to university. Well, you might not know. Yeah, okay. Okay, so you're in a small minority. Yeah, as you saw, many people, your fathers did not go to university. We're not even talking about your mothers. They had no chance, you know. But quite a few people have fathers. Grandfathers, very, very few. So the result is, of course, that the development of society has led to a need for far more universities. And far more universities, the reason for far more universities is to have more technology, more factories and so on. However, we historians, we also made the most of it. And so in the 50s and 60s, there are far more historians. The number of historians in the 60s is five times more than in the 20s. So it's essentially an inflation of historians. Not really because the government has decided they love historians, but because they've decided they need universities and they don't feel comfortable about saying we want universities without historians. So we're kind of just lucky. We're kind of piggybacking on a wider social development. And that means, who were these people who became historians of the 60s? Well, some of them were from the working class. In the 20s and 30s, if you became a historian, you probably went to Oxford or Cambridge. You probably came from a private school. You came from an elite background. 8 out of 10. In the 1960s, maybe only 6 out of 10 came from an elite background. And so, quite naturally, these historians who had been brought up working class, they were more interested in working class people. They were less interested in only studying kings and so on. And secondly, there was the general advance of the democratic spirit, which meant that ordinary people were becoming to be considered important. And thirdly, in the 50s and 60s, there was some influence of Marxism in British universities. I wouldn't like to exaggerate this, because notice that in Britain there has never been a mass communist party. In France, after the war, you know, the communist party would get 6 million, 7 million votes. This never, ever happened in Britain. Not absolutely impossible. Nevertheless, the communist party in Britain did at some point have significant influence, and especially in the universities. So some of the great British historians like Eric Hobsbawm or E.P. Thompson, they were for a while members of the Communist Party, and wrote E.P. Thompson wrote The Making of the English Working Class, which is a great historical classic, and Eric Hobsbawm wrote 20 books, all of them wonderful. And other people like Asa Briggs, who was not a member of the Communist Party, nevertheless was encouraged to be interested in social structures and people. So what happens? Well, historians are... This move to social history also applies to those people who were working, historians working on the 19th century, the 17th century, and the Middle Ages. Yeah, it's a general tendency that even people working on the Middle Ages, they said, oh, well, yeah, let's not just work on the kings. Yeah, let's look at what was life like for ordinary people in the Middle Ages. So, for example, there's a wonderful book called Religion and the Decline of Magic, which is how in ordinary people's lives the belief in magic declined and the belief in religion rose over a couple of hundred years. Mostly the sources he got were tribunal cases. So of course, ordinary people could not write, but when they were in trouble, the court wrote down, oh yes, what happened to you? And they wrote it all down, and there you go. Okay, so what did this mean? Well, first of all, social historians on the First World War, they began to be interested in civilians. Let's not just write about what soldiers did in the First World War. Let's also write about what happened to civilians in the First World War. How did they feel? What did they do? What did the mothers do when their fathers left to go to war? How did they manage? Could they get money from the government? In fact, you could get money from the government, but not if you were not married when the child was born. So if you have a 6-year-old child and you were married 5 years ago, you've got no money from the government. This was the atmosphere of the time, yeah? No fun. To come back to the definition of social history, here we have introductory text from a journal, History Today. History Today is a historian's journal, and it asks the question, what is social history? A new form of antiquarianism? Celebrating experience at the expense of analysis? The sort of history socialists write? Rescuing the past from the enormous condescension of posterity? Mobilizing popular enthusiasm? What is social history? Now, of course, ce sont des questions faussement naïves, ils ont une idée sur tout ça. But these are the kind of things that people think. Some people imagine social history as a new form of antiquarianism, yeah? Collecting things from the past. Historians don't like antiquarianism. It's collecting things from the past, not really trying to understand it. It's very old, yeah? As we don't really like. In the First World War, you get lots of antiquarians. Oh yeah, I have the 6 different kinds of helmets which German soldiers wore in the 1914, and I've discovered that everybody thinks that this one was introduced in April, but no, it was introduced in March. Now, this is the antiquarian approach to history, a sort of obsessive attention to detail. You may know people like this. Don't send messages to people while I'm teaching history. It's dangerous. Okay, I assure you. Is social history celebrating experience at the expense of analysis? Does that mean we're not analysing, we're just interested in how people lived, or the poor people, and we don't want to understand? Is it reserved to socialists? Do only left-wing people write social history? Are we interested in rescuing the past from the enormous condescension of posterity? Now, condescension of posterity is an expression invented by E.P. Thompson. And it's a very important idea, because when we look into the past, we know more than they did, you know. And it's very, very easy to say, you know, oh, why did all those people go to war in the First World War? They must have been pretty stupid 100 years ago. Now that's an extreme example, but it's very, very easy to imagine that today we are much smarter than the people 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, and 300 years ago. And in fact, we're not. We're not. We're in a different situation, but we're not smarter. We're not less smart either, I think, in general. And finally, mobilizing popular enthusiasm, yes, because historians like it when a lot of people are interested in history. And so how can you get a lot of people interested in history? Well, it's difficult to get people to read history books, isn't it? You could get people to watch history films. Has anybody seen Au revoir là-haut? Which is sorti il y a 15 jours, yeah. Did you like it?
Yes.
And it does have history in it, yeah?
Yes.
So people will watch history. People might read an article about history in a newspaper. But you've got to agree that sometimes documentaries on the television, sometimes. And sometimes they try to make them a little bit exciting. It's quite difficult to get people to read history books. Novels. People will read novels about history, and some of the novels about history have a lot of real history in them, and some of them don't. Okay, so that's ideas. In this field of social history, you begin to get books about the home front. And so here you get an example, an oral history of life in Britain during the First World War. So here they interviewed people, old people, who had lived through the First World War, who were not soldiers. So, you know, what was your life like? And they found a lot of interesting things. There's a wonderful témoignage, how do you say that in English? A wonderful extract in here about a woman. And she worked for a butcher. Her man was a butcher. Or her father was a butcher. She was 16 or 17, or maybe a little older. And at the time, butchers, what butchers did is they came to the middle class house every day, say, "What would you like to buy today?" Because of course nobody has a fridge. You know, so that if you have a little money, the butcher will come to your house every day because you can't keep meat for very long. Because her father had gone to war and they needed the money, she began to deliver the meat instead of her father. And many of the customers, men and women, refused. "Oh, no, it's not right for a woman to deliver meat. I'm not accepting it." Yeah. I thought it was very interesting. And what was interesting about it is that men and women refused. Not all of them. Yeah. After a while, maybe they wanted some meat. But it's interesting how rigid the ideas could be at the time. You got lots of things there. A little bit, home front, 1914 to 18. And there you have some of the photographs, yes. So, first of all, notice women wearing trousers. This is not common at the time. It was something which was possible in the war, yeah. And home front, 1914 to 1918. Ian Beckett, look at the subtitle, "How Britain Survived the Great War." So it's a particular idea there. The home front of the Great War. So a series of books on the home front, or as you say in French, le front intérieur. However, this word is a little bit problematic, because to call Britain the home front is to look at everybody's lives from the point of view of the military priority. Whereas in fact, people in Britain during the 1914 to 1918 had a lot of different priorities. And certainly not true that their only priority was winning the war. Well, they didn't want to lose the war, but they might be more interested in making sure their children are fed. And interestingly enough, if you were poor, which a lot of people were poor, and you were in Britain during the war, you probably ate better than previously, because there was no unemployment. Yeah, in 1910. There's lots of unemployment, and when you're unemployed, you've got nothing from the government, of course, and you went hungry. During the war, there was no unemployment, so in fact, and also wages went up during the war because they needed people in the factories to encourage people to come to the factories, because they couldn't militarize the whole of life, so they didn't conscript everybody into the factories. They gave them good wages, and so if you were poor and you didn't get and you didn't go to war, you could actually live better. I mean, of course, that's something difficult to measure, because if your father and your brother might die any day in France, you might not be very happy. But on the from the point of view of not watching your children die of hunger, there was something to be said for it. History of the home fronts. And here is a recent example by Gerard de Groot, British Society in the Era of the Great War. And that's an important example because he doesn't use the expression the home fronts. So perhaps he's trying to get away from it. And he used the expression Blighty. Now, Blighty is slang for Britain or England. And it comes from an Indian language, I don't know which one. I'm sure you remember the British colonized India many hundreds of years ago. Many British middle class men and women would go out to India for a few years to work as administrators. So some elements of Indian languages, some words from Indian languages came into English. And Blighty is one of them. Blighty is La Belle Angleterre in slang. Some books were written about particular groups of workers, railway workers, British railway workers and workers at war, 14 to 18, British industry in the First World War, in a 2014 book. The manual workers had a particularly interesting time in the war because quite often they were not allowed to join the army. For example, at the beginning of the war, many miners joined the army. And a few months later, they sent them home because the only way of making the factories work to produce uniforms and weapons and so on was by coal. And so if you didn't have enough miners, and so after some, we don't want any miners volunteering. And this is where you've got this strange situation where for the only time probably in history, the proportion of middle-class men killed in the First World War is higher than the proportion of working-class men. And I think this is the only war where this is possible. Of course, in later wars, you can imagine, in the Vietnam War, the middle-class men could often find a way of, they often had friends in Canada, or could find some way out of it. And the working class men had no choice. But in the First World War, strangely enough, the middle class men died more. I went to my university. I was at university at King's College, Cambridge, and there are a few hundred people, students every year. And there's a list of the men killed in the First World War. And it's a huge list, and it's a small. It's about the size of the English department in Rouen. And a huge number of people died. It was the war where the elite died as much as everybody else. Okay, so social history could look at particular industries, particular social groups, or very often and very popular, there would be local history. So, for example, here you have, edited by Mike Woods and Tricia Platts, Bradford in the Great War. And there are many, many more. Almost every town in Britain has a book about the town in the First World War. But there's something more interesting about this. Look at who wrote it. The Bradford World War I group. So, not university historians, but local enthusiasts. Typically, you would imagine that they have a couple of retired teachers helping them to research, but that they are local people who are not intellectuals. So, the rise of social history allowed people outside university to work on it, and very often local history became more and more popular. Even today, I mean, if you go into almost any town in Britain, you can find books about what happened to our town during the First World War. So you get this this idea of attachments in there. So that one is Dover and Folkestone during the First World War. Newmarket Local History Society on the First World War. And there you can see another obvious development, and that is that although books are extremely important to history. There's also your documentaries, but there's also things like websites, which of course much cheaper to write. If you want to write and publish a book, you need a bit of money and a lot of time. A documentary, you need more money and more. You need more money, perhaps not more time. Whereas websites, like, it's very, very easy to set them up. You get blogs on the First World War. You also get Twitter accounts on the First World War. In January, I'm going to Washington to the American Historical Association, which is the biggest historical organization with historians in the world. And they have, there's a list of meetings, there's like 200 meetings. And one of them is History Bloggers and Twitter Historians. There's a meeting for history bloggers and Twitter historians. So historians are thinking of how can you use new technology really to get the history out. Now, this doesn't create history. If you want to write the history, you still need paper because that's where the information is. But it can get you out. Well, the history is created on paper for the moment. I say that because when I tell people, I wrote a book about popular song in the First World War, and people say, oh, did you get all the information off the internet? And in fact, the answer is no, there is nothing on the internet. There will be now because I have written it and people can put it on the internet. But the internet does not produce knowledge, you know. Somebody has to put it there, yeah. So you can find sometimes some sources on the internet, but you don't find the history there. And for the First World War, still today, if somebody wanted to study and write a history of the First World War, you can't do it without paper. You can't do it on the internet because it's you wouldn't be finding anything new. And of course, nobody produced websites in 2000 and in 1914. Another one, Hove and the Great War. Again, these are particular towns and their... there can also be... you could also choose, if you're writing social history, you can choose to study particular organisations. But before that, you can choose to study particular social groups. As people realise very, very slowly that most history books just talk about men... they began to write more history books about women. So there you have Women Workers in the First World War by Gail, whatever her name is, Gail Braden. That's a book by Lynn McDonald, one of the women who's become a military historian. Well, it's kind of social, kind of military. The Rose of Nomads, the nurses, British nurses in France. Fascinating book, because most of the British nurses in France were volunteers. And they were volunteers from bourgeois families because working class mothers couldn't leave because they had to work in the factory or work as a domestic servant and feed the children, yeah? Whereas bourgeois women, young women, had the possibility to leave for a year or two. And so they arrived in France as volunteer nurses and they were under the authority of the sister, the professional nurse, and the professional nurses came from the working class. And so you have this very, very strange thing where these bourgeois women were suddenly under the orders of working class women, which was very violent for them in these days, you know, because they weren't used to this. These people were used to having servants, and suddenly somebody who was the kind of person who would be their servant was the boss. They were also, the hospitals in France were also terrified of their nurses getting into delicate situations with the soldiers, as they used to say. Yeah. And so it was the incredibly strict rules, yeah? If one of the soldiers called you by your first name, you probably lost your job. Yeah. It was extremely strict. There was a general terror, in particular, of bourgeois women getting too close to working class men. That was considered to be really, 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 really terrible. So they had these extremely strict rules about what to do. But also, these were bourgeois women, you know, and suddenly they found themselves in hospitals with looking at these horrible injuries, you know, with people's legs coming off and screaming and dying. And it was a big shock for them, as you can imagine, yeah? It was a big shock for them. Interesting, wonderful book. And this one is also about women, but this is about a particular two women, Elsie and Mary. There they are. And they asked to, they wanted to help with the war efforts, but nobody wanted them. And so they went over to Belgium and they joined the Belgium ambulance thing, and they just drove an ambulance around Europe. They were motorcycle enthusiasts. And I think it's an important example because, we all know that there were not so many possibilities for women 100 years ago, that there was less freedom than today. We know that. But it's very important to remember that there was a big variety. There were always, even if 9 out of 10 women followed the rules, there were always some. And these two women before the war used to go around Britain on a motorbike, on a motorcycle. And there's always been quite a variety. And it's very important that we don't get into a rigid thing. We say, oh yes, 100 years ago, all women were like that. It's not the case. They were just as varied as they were, as they are today. And this one I've already mentioned to you. And this one is munitions workers in the Great War. It has to be said that although there has been some books written on women's experience in the First World War, not many. There is still a big lack of simply books about what happened to women, what women's lives were like during the First World War. And strangely enough, there appear to be more books about women novelists and the First World War than about just women who lived in the First World War. It's not been really attacked for the moment. If you're not studying a particular group, you could study a particular organisation. I'm afraid you're dead, both of you. Okay, you can study a particular organisation. For example, Alan Wilkinson's wonderful book about the, written in 1930, so it's an early one, the Church of England and the First World War. The Church of England was an enthusiastic supporter of the First World War. It's Berlin against Bethlehem. This was the line that they had. Yeah, Berlin against Bethlehem. Yeah, the mailed fist against the nailed hand. You know, Jesus on the cross against the. So they were not subtle about it. But there have been a few books recently trying to give a more positive view, but not very convincing in my view. This is a history of the Conservative Party during the First World War. So you can take a particular organisation. There are many organisations, you know, that people could write a history of the Boy Scouts and the First World War. Or the Football Association and the First World War. You know, there's a whole load of things that can be done. Strangely enough, although social history for other periods, for example, the 19th century, has written an awful lot about trade unions, there is no major work on the trade unions during the First World War in Britain. This is unusual because the number of people who were members of trade unions rose very rapidly during the war, and there were large strikes in 1916, 1918 and 1919. In fact, in 1918 there was even a police strike. The police of London were on strike in 1918, which is very unusual, of course, for the police to be on strike. This is a book about the trade unions in the United States during the First World War, but there is not one about Britain for the moment. And you have something like that where you have some information on Britain, France and Britain, labour at war in France and Britain. But to such an extent, it's so little studied that if you go into the British Library, into the website of the British Library, and you're looking for a book on trade unions in the First World War in Britain, well, you go into the search engine and you search for it. You can see I put First World War in inverted commas, so it stays together. First World War trade unions, very simple. And the machine answers, did you mean First World War trenches? So it's saying it has absolutely nothing about the trade unions in the First World War. It just thinks, oh, you must be talking about something else. Thank you. Anyway, that was rather shocking here. There isn't one either in France either, yeah, because I looked in the Bibliothèque Nationale, and there is one book written at the time by a revolutionary trade unionist, but otherwise there isn't much going on there. Otherwise, you could enter into social history, other social aspects of the Great War. This is a very, very old one. The Sexual History of the World War by Magnus Hirschfeld. This was written in the 1920s. This is an exception. Magnus Hirschfeld was a pioneer campaigner for homosexual rights in Germany in 1900. He was one of the very, very first ones. Who's been a little lot, everybody's forgotten him, in fact, but he was a great pioneer. It would be a good day today for him to come back from the other side and have a look around, because yesterday Australia voted for gay marriage, so he would be he's a happy man today. Some particular aspects can be looked at. The British working class and enthusiasm for war. So this tries to answer the question, how much enthusiasm was there? This has also been a difficult question, because on the day that the war began, there were demonstrations in London. Hey, it's great, we're at war. But demonstrations like with a few thousand people. But demonstrations like this are difficult to interpret. You know, a few thousand people. What do they represent? And that's always difficult to say. When you have a demonstration, you know, you learn something. But is it representative? You know, very difficult to say. Even, you know, today, this week in Barcelona, we have big demonstrations for independence and big demonstrations against independence. You know, who's representative? These are very difficult, very, very difficult questions. Just one more. No, two more, and then we're finished for today. The stomach for fighting. This is a woman historian who's decided to write about food. But the stomach fighting, food and the soldiers of the Great War. This is not a recipe book. This is a very interesting history book. And it's also about what did the food mean to people. For example, it could be, you know, resources are scarce during the First World War. But the English soldiers will not eat horse, because it's difficult for them, yeah? They don't like the idea, yeah? Or the question, all sorts of things about what did food mean to them, as well as things about what they ate. So that could be considered to be social history, but you notice here, and we will come back to this later, that in fact it's classed under cultural history. Now the last one then, Healing the Nation, Soldiers and the Culture of Caregiving in Britain during the Great War. The culture of caregiving. Okay, so that was social history. The third field is cultural history, and that's the one I'm going to be looking at next week. Remember to have a look at the blog and see if I've put up anything for you there. Thank you for listening.